Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this. Peter, today's topic, what is it that you do? No, what is it? You wrote it more
this is
eloquently.
Episode 203, what is our work?
All right, you made this one up. You want to start?
Yeah, okay. I am a librarian. I'm an academic librarian at the Georgia Tech Library. Mm-hmm. There was a time when I thought that to be a librarian was to be mostly concerned with books. You know, that when I was young, I loved books.
Or as you used to call it, the collection.
The collection.
Is that what you call it, the collection?
Well, that, yeah. I mean, the library's collection is called the collection.
Yeah. And or as a kid, I remember it was mainly books.
Mainly books. Maybe some magazines, too. Mm-hmm. And these days, my work has nothing to do with what I imagined libraries were or what librarians were.
Now it's all roller derby and cotton candy.
That's very nice. Where did that come from?
Well, when you guys do the, what do you call it, the rec party?
Rats night.
Rats night. And rat is, we have this rat cap. Rat means recently acquired tech student.
Yeah, because it used to be recruit at tech, so there were rats. But then we went co-ed, so and then it's recently acquired tech student.
Oh, recruit isn't like a military recruit?
Exactly.
Like a buzz cut and
things like that?
So you guys do have dodgeball and cotton candy and popcorn.
Yeah, it's true.
And pizza.
It's true.
It's actually quite a rocking time.
I mean, a library is what? It's a collection of resources to record the work, the creative output and intellectual output of the present so that it can be used in the future.
And a good illustration of how your job has changed in its original focus on books to alternative media would be smart tech. Scholarly materials
and research at tech. Yeah.
Which, for example, my radio show gets cataloged in and a lot of things.
All you have to do is think about like a terabyte of data coming out of a experiment or coming out of a supercomputer.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, well, that is material. That is research material. You know?
Right.
No longer do people have a academic career that they sum up in books? You know, like, it's time to write my book on this particular research thing and then move on to my next topic. So my job, what is my work? Personally, my work is now trying to figure out how to create a librarian who is essentially a podcasting librarian. I'm trying to make a job out of that. Someone who
How's it going for you?
It's all right. I mean, I'm the public engagement librarian, and part of my job is to recruit and facilitate new media. Mm-hmm.
Is it
outreach.
Making a difference? Do you have people that engage you because of your work on the radio and podcasts and things like that saying, you know, I had no idea Georgia Tech had projects like this. This is exciting. I want to get involved. I want to go to Georgia Tech. I want to get involved in that research project.
I haven't gotten there yet. Right now what I'm doing is I'm going to classes and, you know, teaching students how to handle a podcast assignment, you know, giving them conceptual frameworks to approach a podcast assignment and helping faculty members launch their own podcasts.
Let me ask you a question. What positive learning outcome comes from you teaching them how to do a podcast or even WRK, the radio, right? You have a freshman seminar GT1000 class that is built around here. So teaching people how to talk on the radio, how to do a podcast, what's the positive learning outcome for that?
Well,
who cares?
I think that any communication that we can indulge in, right, it would be good if we understood it, at least as a consumer and maybe as a practitioner. Students who come into college and they've written however many papers and they've had to do, I don't know, you know, projects. Like I remember in grade school, I laid out a fake copy of Time magazine, and it was I think it was Louis Pasteur was who I was man of the year for my fake time.
I can see the potential value for this.
Yeah, so, you know, I did a report on Louis Pasteur, but it was in the form of a Time magazine.
You did what's the name of that? We use a lot of images. It's called, the students love it.
What?
There's a name for that layout that's mainly graphical. A graphical object something or other.
A GUI.
No, graphical that's not
user
it.
Interface.
Not a graphical
anyway,
user
you're
interface.
Not going to remember. Yeah. Let me keep talking.
Okay.
And I think that made my brain wrinkle in certain ways that just writing a paper would not have.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's what I add. I give the students and the professor options in how they communicate mm-hmm. creatively and intellectually, and in doing so, help them sort of do the metacognition of thinking about how they're communicating.
Oh, okay. And I agree. And I think what that results in is some additional practice and understanding of communication in general,
yeah.
even if that's not how you're going to communicate down
and
the road.
In the future, if audio communication, podcasting is like just what everybody does,
yeah.
you know, if like everybody, you know, records their speech into something to do
yeah.
grocery lists or to, you know, apply
and that's
for
okay.
things. But I'm saying, like, at that point, me doing this would not be as useful.
Right.
It would not
Agreed.
Be,
Agreed.
You know, stretching.
But you'll be
people.
On to the next big thing.
I'll be dead.
And whatever it is, so many of our students, when they come in, they are frozen in their tracks at the idea of communicating things, let alone communicating things efficiently
right.
and effectively.
They imagine that communication is yeah. the assignment. Like, what does the teacher want yeah. me to do? As opposed yeah. to the teacher would like you, the professor would like you to deliver to them
yeah.
something that shows that you applied yeah. some kind of critical framework to yeah. some idea and produced some kind of work.
Yeah. And the one thing they don't learn when they write papers is that shorter is better. And if you want to communicate to the normal public, you have to learn how to vet which technical details you leave out.
Yeah.
So yesterday we were doing sort of pitch practice for the semifinalists of the Invention Prize.
You mean practicing the pitch?
Practicing the pitch. For their invention, right? So these are potentially people that we selected as finalists. They're going to do their pitches this Thursday. And it's hard to do it in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And to convince people. But this is life, whether you are in sales or you're in academics trying to get a grant, or you are working for a nonprofit trying to convince someone to invest in something, or trying to help someone who doesn't want to be helped. This kind of communication is extremely important. So any new creative things, podcasts, poster sessions,
mm-hmm.
that is a thing, unless you've done a science fair, you're not familiar with it, but academics do it all the time. I'm actually giving a research poster at the upcoming meeting in Florida of the Association of Applied Therapeutic Humor. And to create.
That's essentially creating a landing spot for you to do a pitch.
Oh, it is, right. All these things are pitches. Here's my research. Here's why it's important.
Saying,
here's why it
hey,
makes a difference.
Hey, come look at this, and then I'll talk at you.
But people need to do that. And if you find new and creative ways to do that, that just keep people out of getting a rut, I think that's great.
All right, Pete, we've kind of backed our way into uh-huh. your answer to this question.
Oh.
What's your work? What
God.
Is your work, Peter?
We have several components, as illustrated in the format for my year-end reports and my curriculum vitae.
What is your title?
One, research. Associate Professor of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering.
There you go. Now what's your job?
One, do research. And that means research productivity is exactly what our last podcast was on, scholarly communication. Are you publishing in journals? Are you publishing in journals that have a wide readership? Are you publishing in journals that get cited a lot? And that is measured via a metric called impact factor. It's not perfect, but it does tell you something about whether or not things are widely read. If you do weird stuff like me that involves educational outreach, doesn't always end up in the high impact
yeah,
factor
right.
journals. Ends up on weird things where
you
I have
to
measure it by the number of people
to put into your,
that walk up to me and say,
dossier.
Oh, where do you teach chemical engineering? George Tech? That's cool. Maybe I'll go there. You know, that's a very intangible thing. So one is research. The other is education, right? Are you teaching students? And that is something that's more important to me than some of my other colleagues here. And then the other one is service. So service is, you know, do you provide service to the professional societies to help with journals, to help with conferences, right, to oversee,
yeah.
you know, sessions at these conferences and things like
that. I actually had to join committee on the Georgia Libraries, in the Georgia Library mm-hmm. Association, because my next promotion, I go
Dependent
up in
it.
4 years.
Yeah.
And that's what I have to do. I have to have some service in a...
External to Georgia
State
Tech.
Level yeah. organization, yeah.
But that's a good thing, right? I mean,
yeah, it is a good thing.
You
but
may find out they have some interesting ideas you can adapt. You may find they don't know
it
their ass from a hole in the ground.
It's very programmatic. Like, part of me, and this I think is the thing that you and I share completely in mm-hmm. our jobs, is that there is a checklist
yeah.
of things we have to do to right. to kind of any quality level.
Right.
Like, you can't screw it up terribly and
right.
still do it, but you can be a mediocre member,
yeah.
a mediocre volunteer,
yeah.
you know, at some conference for yeah. biochemistry, and I could be a mediocre member of the GLA committee, and it would still, uh-huh. kind of fulfill that requirement,
right,
that our job description shows, right?
Yeah.
You could publish a very boring article and it would still be your research. You'd still be publishing.
Yeah, I mean, you can have an article that is referenced a lot, but it's referenced by saying, you know, the original model, you know, hypothesized by Ludovitz and co-workers is crap. That's what you should do. And I'm shocked for that sort of thing. But
they call that the bullshit factor.
But that's why one of the forms of scholarly communication that we left off was, you know, non-traditional things.
You mean last, from last episode.
From our last episode, yeah. Non-traditional things. And that's why many people are, when they do teaching, they create a portfolio.
Yeah.
And a portfolio is something that is not new to your people.
Come on.
Look, in the age of Trump, I like saying your people. Yeah, it gets a lot of people pissed off. And by that, I mean more the humanities type folks. If you are an architect, if you are an artist, you have. If you are a dress designer,
yeah,
you have a portfolio. You show the pictures
evidence
about where they
work.
Were used and style elements. And
all right, don't
like
go
that.
Down this road, though. Let's okay. talk about our work,
yeah,
right? So which part do you like? What's the thing that you dig, and what's the thing that you could do without?
Actually, I like all parts of it. What bothers me the most is that I don't fit into a particular category, so it's hard for me to communicate this stuff.
What do you mean category? Like, what would be your options?
You know, I publish in some journals that are not indexed in the Web of Science, which is the standard by which we do things, right? So in my report, I'm like, you know, how many papers have you authored that are in the Web of Science? How many folks have cited them the Web of Science?
Yeah, what's your count in the WAS?
So
that's not a thing people say.
For example, I mean, some of the work I publish along with my colleague Cliff Henderson.
I just made that out. I made that up. I thought you were going to join me in that.
I figured
one,
somebody probably called it that. We actually write out the Web of Science. But for example, there is a and they are refereed proceedings for this SPI meeting, the Society of Optical Engineers. If you work with industry and you're making the next generation of CPUs, of computer chips, this is where you publish. And it's very agile and it changes every year, and they publish a lot, as opposed to the Journal of American Chemical Society, which is a more fundamental study.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tend to do things a little bit differently, and you know, where do I put running a radio show informing the public about science and technology? That's hard to put down there.
Yeah, so why did you start doing that?
I do it because it's something I like to do. I like the educational
yeah, but there's
component.
A lot of things,
I like the outreach.
There's a lot of things that people like to do that they're not able to do, especially not at work.
Okay.
Why are we able to do this? Sit here and do a podcast that, you know, relatively few people listen to compared to, say, how many students you teach in a year.
Right.
Or
right.
You
and
know.
It's because I taught 374 students last year.
No, wait.
I actually totaled them up. That's not including my research students.
I believe that you did that. But why are we allowed to do this? Like, this is the faculty status, which we both have. You have a slightly better faculty status than I do.
Yeah, that remains to be seen.
Well, you're more important and you make more money, right?
But that and $10 will get you a latte at Starbucks.
I think they're actually only like $6 now. But we have this freedom, this sort of do what you like kind of freedom.
Yeah.
Certainly one day a week. If you go by my 80-20 distribution of work, like one day a week, I should just do whatever. Scholarship.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
I heard that beeping thing. I don't know what it is.
That was crazy. I'm just going to leave it in.
The revolution may be beginning, and it will not be televised.
Just in case you and I die, I want that
there was a warning.
This recording
Let's
to be
just
like,
leave it in there.
Well, we heard the beeps of when their hearts failed.
It did kind of like a sound, like an EKG, didn't it?
Oh, and by the way, if you, the listener, don't know what the hell we're talking about, there was like the lights flashed and there were beep, beep, like two beeps. Maybe the mics didn't pick it up, but just so you know, that's why we started talking crazy all of a sudden. I thought I had a stroke. Can I tell you a story about a professor I had once?
Okay. So is this a good story or a bad story?
It's a pretty good story.
Okay, that's good.
I had a professor of performance theory, avant-garde performance theory, and he...
We had a course like that at Tech?
Oh, yeah.
And sweet.
He showed movies a lot, so he had like the studio classroom, no windows, right? You could close it up and then watch a movie, right? And he was... Did you hear that?
Yeah, it was like a timpani drum.
There's boom, a lot boom. Of stuff happening, everybody. We're just going to...
I'm waiting for the theme from 2001 to start.
We're going
to
run forward and see what happens.
Boom, 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 boom.
But he... So we had this
avant-garde
classroom.
Performance...
no light
theory
entered the classroom if you close the door. So he's lecturing, he's telling us all this stuff, and the power goes out. Mm-hmm. The power goes out, the room goes completely dark, the whole class goes, hey! And when the lights come back on, he's looking at us, and he's got this ghosted look on his face.
He's not like naked in the front.
And he says that the moment the lights went out, he actually thought to himself, my God, this is how it ends. I've had a heart attack. And then he heard the whole class go, hey!
And he thought that he was walking into the light
or
something.
He thought that he was hearing our response to him keeling over dead.
Oh. Well, that's sad.
It was a little
bit. But it sounded like you found this guy rather engaging and enjoyed his class.
We enjoyed him, yeah.
Even if you didn't, you wouldn't wish for his death, would you?
No, absolutely not. I've never wished for any professor's death.
That's good.
Except for one.
Okay. I can only think of two colleagues I've wished for their death.
Well, that professor slept with a friend of mine's girlfriend.
Wow. Holy crap. Talk about going down the Animal House road toward the end here. The final stretch.
He totally...
What a coincidence. Oh. I have a husband named Dean Wormer.
Crap. I just forgot his name. Who's that actor? Wow. I can't remember his name
at all. Talking about from Animal House?
Donald Sutherland.
Yes, he was the professor. So, I'm not joking. This is my job. Ironically, the theme of this podcast.
Okay. So, your faculty status, cooler than mine. But we both have faculty status, which allows us a certain leeway.
Yeah.
We can just do stuff.
Yeah.
Not sleep with students. We can just do stuff like record a podcast or try to come up with a lab.
But I think we both have contributed to a lot of outreach and things like that. It's very subtle. It's very intangible.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that it's okay because we're doing something else. This is not what we're supposed to do. We have to make up for it by doing other things.
Okay, but that's the model. So let's take, for example, W.L. Gore, this corporation, which runs their corporation in a very deliberate way. They have smaller locations, and they go by Malcolm Gladwell's theory that you can only interact with so many people.
Where are you going with this?
So I interviewed a guy from W.L. Gore in research, and he was allowed to, you know, they say like 20% of the time, maybe it's closer to 15-10, to just use their imagination and look at new things. And they do. And they go, they spend part of their budget, they buy machines and they take them apart and they think about things and they build weird things. And if only 1 in 1,000 of those generates a truly remarkable idea, that is money well spent. And the academic philosophy is the same, that you are allowed to go off and do new and interesting things if you can show that ultimately they will contribute to the common good for research, service, or education.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. And you are not allowed to be fired for that.
Right, right.
And a good example is Ed Coyle. Ed Coyle started the VIP, Vertically Integrated Projects course here. It's a weird thing, and we're still trying to get it gelled here and going. So I teach one, and you probably know some people that teach as well. It's an exciting idea, and it's a bit of a revolution. And it takes time. It takes time to get these things right. So as long as you are working in a reasonable fashion towards something that can make a contribution, they leave you alone. It's kind of like when there's objection, and it goes, well, you know, Mr. Harris, you better get to a question quickly. I'll grant you a little bit of latitude. Right. This is our little bit of latitude.
Can people start companies while they're professors?
Sure. Let them do.
How does that work?
If you're a professor, Georgia Tech takes its cut.
Okay.
I don't want to use a Merchant of Venice thing, but a pound of flesh is probably apropos.
Well, don't use a Merchant of Venice thing then.
The neat thing
they
is...
They take a little bit off the
top.
If
you are a student, particularly an undergraduate student, and you are just doing undergraduate research and not being sponsored by a federal contract or a company, you own that intellectual property. And I will tell you this, that this is the thing that excites me the most. So as a chemical engineer, I have to teach students about differential equations and mass balances and energy balances and mass transport and energy transport and all these things. Yeah. This is important. These are the fundamental principles of chemical engineering. But then once they learn it, it's exciting to watch them, for example, right now in the class I'm co-teaching with three colleagues, figure out how to make the frying oil in a kettle chip fryer better. It's kind of neat. I mean, who doesn't like kettle chips? Have you ever had a kettle chip?
I have.
Good stuff.
They're good.
Like kettle chips. And the companies that's sponsoring it, I don't know if I should mention them or not, so I'm not going to, but it's a big company and they make, you know, a lot of potato chips and they make some pretty good stuff. This is an exciting project to get them excited about doing something new that's never been done before. And I'm currently working with a number of folks, and one of my students, they want to make a better tampon. They want to make a flushable tampon. And let's face it, if you ask anyone that sucks cesspools or you know, for a living, they're not really flushable, right? And as uncomfortable as you are, me talking about this, it's an interesting idea. They did not make the semifinals of the Venture Prize competition, but I told them, you know, let's meet every week. Let's talk about this. This is a neat idea. And whether that idea triumphs for them or a spinoff of that idea or something completely different, they will get inspired and engaged in thinking about how to take material science and chemical engineering to do good things to improve the lives of people on this planet. That's what excites me the most about education.
So let me ask you a question about what I want to do.
Okay.
Let's say...
You said if you won the lottery, you would just watch movies and read books all day.
Oh, shit, yeah.
You know, all I was day. Thinking about it the other day. I'm like, I might not be far off.
I'd start doing drugs again. Listen, so...
The fall of Western civilization.
What if I wanted to start a media company here at Tech?
Okay.
Where we made radio,
okay, you know,
and probably it would be distributed. We'd be like a independent producer at Tech, and I wanted to distribute audio based on things that happened here.
Yeah,
could I be a company here at Tech and do that?
That'd be tough. So you need to have dividing lines between them.
Uh-huh.
So say you take intellectual property. Usually you discover some principal intellectual property. Georgia Tech gets, you know, its cut if you, the professor, did it under a contract. The nice thing is if you developed it under a federal contract, the federal government, what was the name of the act? It was a law made quite some time ago. That allowed people that developed intellectual property on the government's dime to sort of take it and exploit it.
Mm-hmm.
The Bayh-Dole Act, right?
Oh, okay.
And it used to be that the government owned all that, and there were a lot of barriers to you developing it until the government realized none of this is being turned into companies. This is bad. Let's just let the people do it, give them the bulk of the profits. And the government can always cherry pick stuff and say, oh, I need this for defense purposes, so I get an exclusive or a non-exclusive. And that's fine. So they can pick what they need, but they don't need a lot of it. And it was the Defense Department that actually coined this term dual use,
mm-hmm.
that you would research the fundamental properties of materials because you're trying to make a better missile housing, you're trying to make a better bulletproof vest. But if you could use that for... you know, abrasion-resistant clothing and making household products out of it, that was great. So when you do that and you spin off the company, there are distinct rules. You must have separation. And sometimes people don't separate things, and that's when you get into trouble with a lot of the scenarios described in a book called University Inc.
Mm.
Jennifer, I forget her last name, but it was a brilliant book. And it talked about how graduate students are
University
working on this.
University Incorporated.
Yeah, University Inc., INC period. And there are graduate students who are working on a project and it's related to the company, but it's related to their thesis. And then in the end, they're like, oh, I'm going to go publish my thesis. And it is okay for a company sponsored project or a spinoff company to say, I'm going to embargo your results for a year. And so you can't publish it for a year because it's relevant to our intellectual property. Okay. To me, that's a reasonable compromise. You can do that. That's not too bad. Then go ahead and publish it. You get credit for it. And it's associated with intellectual property that's even more valuable.
Right.
But some students get caught between a rock and a hard place, and suddenly all their work disappears. They can't publish it. They're not sure if it's part of the company. They get caught in between, and that's what this book, University Inc., highlights. That is a real problem. So you're better off sort of developing protocols and ideas and ways of doing things here via a nonprofit. What did we talk about? A center for media development for students to do this, which would be a really cool thing and right up the alley of what you're doing and what I'm doing. Because my GT1000, we did a podcast.
How do you start one of those?
Well, there you got to get funding. I think we should talk to Karen Head and the...
Can you start a nonprofit in your school and have that be
part of
your
really
job?
You would have to do it as an arm of Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
And
well, that's what I mean. Sorry, in your university.
But then you can always take it, and all you need is a board of directors.
Taking it. I just want to do the work, you know?
Right. But why not do it as part of a center here at Georgia Tech? Get external funding.
I mean, that sounds good, too.
Yeah. I mean, that's how most of the research is done here. So the DOD, the DOE, NIH, NSF, private foundations, companies give us money to do this interesting research.
But when you say a center, do you mean something that exists or make up a center that exists?
Just make it up.
All right.
And you usually start with a big initiation grant, so a grant that would fund this kind of media stuff.
Right.
You can always get small grants from places like the National Science Foundation to look at this sort of thing. But you might want to find a foundation. The Sloan Foundation, for example, which likes to fund...
The NEH has a grant for like media programs.
NEH, that's great. National...
Endowment for the Humanities.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So just sort of describe a version of this. So, you know, I'm a librarian.
Right.
Right? I produce radio and podcasts.
Right.
I would like to do that as a more sort of substantial part of my job.
Right.
And in my job description, there's... a very easily translatable piece to facilitate and recruit new media outreach, intellectual outreach, right?
Right, and you point out why this is important. Yeah. It helps our students communicate better. It communicates what we do here at Georgia Tech to the public better.
So let's say I sell whoever on that, but then what would I do? What do you think is the
pucker up, baby, because then you got to get money.
And how do I – but why am I getting the money?
You're getting the money because you're doing something good to the educational and research outreach mission
of
Georgia
Tech. I feel like you're jumping past
something. If you can't quote sections from the mission statement from the strategic plan of Georgia Tech, you're not getting
anything. Well, I can. I looked
into
that.
Yeah, you can.
So what? I'm going to go to the director of the Writing and Communications Program and say, can I have a center in your program?
Well, say, this is what I'm thinking. We take part of what you do, get those guys involved, because isn't this communication?
Yeah,
right? So anytime you can leverage current resources, then you might want some more money to build out particular rooms for studios like we record here, podcasts, things like that. You get some of it from the Institute if you can show a grant. So here's what you want, matching funds.
Uh-huh.
If you can get a grant for $500,000 and say, look, can you kick in $200,000 and we do this thing? And that's how all these centers pop up and then sometimes disappear, because getting the maintenance funding, the sustainable funding, is the hardest part. And you build this thing and you start a curriculum and you interact with GT1000 courses and you interact with other courses.
Do you think I could do this as not a professor, or would I have to have a professor?
I don't think you have to be a professor. You could find lots of professors who would work with you. I'd work with you. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
Karen Head, who runs the Communication Center?
Yeah, she's the director of the Communication Center.
She would be interested. This is how we started the Invention Studio.
Yeah.
So you want to do the media version of the Invention Studio.
Huh.
Let's do it, man.
It's very complicated.
Thanks for listening. We've got to go to this.
But the point I'm sort of, like, I'm enjoying this conversation. Yeah. We'll have to keep doing it off air. But I it's very confusing. Like, what are we if we can do something like that? If I just need to figure out how to get some money, you know, and then talk my supervisor into letting me go do this instead of something else.
Yeah, you'd probably only do this part-time, but you could rewrite your job description.
Well, my job description matches this mostly.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
So I could definitely do that.
But if you're helping students, if you're improving educational outcomes and you're doing outreach on the beautiful things we're doing at Georgia Tech, you should get involved with, who's the director of Seismic? Lizanne, I forget her last name. Seismic does a lot of this. This is our K-12 outreach branch. They may have money for you. And more importantly, we're working with Lizanne to do a grant on a conference on the value of applied humor. I mean, that's whacked. But she's the person that could help us write that, because she's in contact with that non-technical side of the National Science
Foundation. So really, we're just nonprofit hustlers.
Everyone's a hustler. If you work for the United Way, you're a hustler. There's nothing wrong with being a hustler.
What about if your fingers get broken by a Minnesota Fats?
Occupational hazard. Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK studios on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology.
And do our opinions reflect those of Georgia Tech or WREK?
I don't think so.